Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. In the last weeks, I've been having a conversation with a gentleman, Stephen Buck, who's also known as Kiyoshi Takahashi. And I was really intrigued by his energy into trying to make sense of Reiki as a whole and on the internet and through his book. And also, I just felt like it was my time to really be out there and be able to be open to speaking to people who, obviously, what we have in common is a passion for Reiki. And I feel like this has been true all through the show, all these years. And most of the time I know the people that I'm interviewing, but today I don't. And Steve and I are going through this a bit blind, and that's really good because I'm really excited about finding out who he is and what he's doing and what his contribution is for us as all of us as Reiki students. So Stephen or Kiyo, please welcome to the show.
Hi, Phyllis. Thank you so much for having me here. And please feel free to call me just by my last name, Buck. Several years ago, actually almost a couple decades ago when I lived in Japan, the native Japanese speakers had a lot of trouble speaking my first name. And it was at that point, there was a turning point in how everyone around me, in the military as well, addressed me. And since that point, my last name stuck. So please, just feel free to call me by my last name,
all
which
right.
is Buck.
Okay, I try.
Yep.
All right. So, Buck, I would love to hear your Reiki story because I'm intrigued by this little hint of living in Japan and so on. And now it's the military, uh-huh. So have at it. Let's hear your story.
Okay. Well, I became involved in Reiki in 1993, and prior to that, though, I was very involved in spirituality. Today I'm 47 years old, but many, many years ago, as long as I can remember, I've always been able to see auras, chakras, the acupuncture meridians, even acupoints within people. And I guess that makes me, based on the people that I've experienced, it makes me a little bit different because I came in to the world seeing what a lot of people awaken to when they're my age nowadays, and sometimes in their 30s as well. So in Japan, I was exploring a lot of different forms of personal spirituality just by going out to the little temples and what have you that were along the base and in other areas around the military base, Iwakuni. And I had a lot of really powerful experiences there that really made me feel attached to the country of Japan as a whole.
Uh-huh.
Well, I got out of this. Go ahead.
Can I just go back to help me with my little chronological brain? So you started and you said that you were born with this ability to really see, you know, a different, how can I put it? See people in with a different veil or something. You know, you could see us in our energy points and so on. So that was really interesting. But then you skipped to Japan. So I'm just wondering, how did you get to Japan? Or were you born in Japan?
No, I ran away from home by joining the Marine Corps.
Interesting.
My contract with the service was for 6 years, and that put me into aviation electronics, and we deployed to Japan for quite a bit of time. There was a total deployment time of about 2 years that I spent it primarily based in Japan when we were based on the West Coast. So
uh-huh.
It was not a continuous 2 years that I spent living there. It was a broken 2 years. The longest term was 6 months in Japan, as far as unbroken time going anyplace else.
Well, so, but my experience of Japan is that because, I don't know why, but because it seems to me, even though I'm Japanese, but of course was born in America and totally am an American, it's a very different culture, and it really feels like you're in a kind of totally separate world. Was that true for you?
Very true. In fact, I had the weirdest experience when I first stepped foot onto the country itself, because I had traveled to many other countries in the past, and Japan was the first country that I stepped foot onto, and it felt like I stepped on home. It felt like I just walked through the front door, and it just felt like the perfect place for me to be. And I fell in love with the country and the culture at that time.
Wonderful. Great. So, but you went to Japan, and you were intrigued by the shrines and so on that they were there?
Well, I was, because I was also looking for explanations of why I could see all this fancy stuff. And other people, I wanted to understand why other people could not. And Buddha, you know, I thought it was weird that people couldn't, because I had grown up with it.
Yeah,
so,
obviously.
You know, Buddhism seemed more accepting of it. They really didn't shun it like Christianity did. Most of the Buddhists just kind of shrugged their shoulders. It's like, okay, so what? Just sit. Just sit and meditate. Be Buddha. You know, no one really cared. And we could talk about other things, which made that very intriguing. But after I got out of the service in 1991, I ended up moving to San Francisco. And there was a really good friend of mine who just insisted that I go attend this Reiki Level 1 class with him. And I said, well, what's this Reiki thing? What is that? Oh, it's just, he said, it's this really powerful form of hands-on healing, and it's just the most phenomenal thing I've ever experienced, and I just know you're going to love it, and I want you to go with me. Please, please, please go. And I said, okay, how much is it? And he said, well, the Level 1 class is $150. And I said, dude, you know, I'd be happy to go to the class with you, but I can't even afford my rent. And I couldn't afford my rent at the time. I was struggling to survive financially. And he begged and he begged and he begged. And I said, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. And I said, he begged some more. And I said, no. And then he turned around and he said, well, I'll pay for it. And I said, well, no, I'm not going to let that happen. And eventually... What I did is I ended up paying him back. So I went to the Reiki Level 1 class, and it was 2.5 days, if I remember correctly. It was Friday night, all day Saturday, and most of the day on Sunday. And it was led by two Reiki masters from Australia. Their names were John and Denise Crundall. And Denise did the attunements, and she was just such an incredibly charismatic speaker.
Yes.
I loved her presentation, and I thought watching the other students in the class, well, it was pretty interesting, but I was also at the time very messed up in the head. And I, as far as the spiritual lights and spiritual special effects, shall we call it, was concerned, I did not see anything in the Reiki Level 1 class that impressed me. And when I got through that class, I was like, okay, good. Now this class is done. I've got this stupid certificate. Now I can go about my life doing whatever it is that I wanted to do and become even more self-destructive with the way that I was living. And as it turned out, the Level 1 was not enough, because my friend came back to me and said, oh, you've got to do the Level 2. It's just the most incredible thing. It's so much more powerful than Level 1. And I said, no, I'm not going to do this. I wasn't impressed with the Level 1 at all. I mean, it's great. People need to go through this, but you know, what they are just waking up to, I already have. I don't need to know this stuff. And he just insisted and begged. And again, it was the same routine. And the only way I could get him to shut up was to say, okay, I'd go to the class. But this class was more of a challenge, not because of the amount of time that it would take to go through it, but because the level two class was $500.
Right.
And that was 1 month's rent right there for me. And I was struggling to pay rent. I mean, I just could not get a job or keep a job to save my life. I was so messed up in the head at the time. And I ended up making it happen. So things worked out. I was able to go to the class, and there it changed me. The Reiki attunements were just incredible. And again, it was by the same instructors, John and Denise Crundall. Denise's aura that second time around was just so much more radiant and brilliant. It's just, I become speechless when I start to remember it. And the attunement process through her as well was so different. And I can say this with hindsight after the fact, but the attunement process from her was so different than other attunements that I've experienced from other people, that because of the level two attunement, it was so powerfully transformative. Even today, I'm 47 years old. I mentioned that earlier, but I'm 47 years old. Even today, something will happen in my life, and I'm able to reflect back to that attunement experience that I had with Denise and say, oh, I've got such a better understanding of this situation now because the information teaching me how to deal with this situation that I'm in right now was taught to me during that attunement. It's almost as if the attunement was a huge data stream of information about things that I need to do to fix my life and to become a better person and to help other people out. And at the time, it was too much, too soon, and I didn't get it. But, you know, over 20 years later, well, not quite 20, but almost 20 years later, now I can look back and say, oh, yes, well, I understand what to do because of the attunement. And the second degree changed me because there I knew it's like, okay, this is something good. I can work with this, and I can learn from this as well. So I can help other people by doing the attunements and by helping them find out more about what it is they need to find out in their life, more about themselves, and more about myself as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. I didn't actually know that Denise came to the States to teach.
She did. I don't know how often it actually happened. I do believe it was mostly a financial loss for her to do so, but which is probably what inhibited her travels. But I know that she did do at least two classes.
Right, obviously.
I've got her signatures on the paper and stamps.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think it's great. And, you know, Beth Gray was from the San Francisco area.
Uh-huh.
Who was her teacher.
I've known about that. And the interesting thing is Denise would not tell anyone at the time who her Reiki master was.
Oh, interesting.
She had some very strict rules about teaching Reiki masters. And I feel I've got mixed feelings about it. I mean, it's good that she stuck to her guns, but in the same way they worked against her. So the first rule, which you're probably familiar with, is the $10,000 rule, and pardon me for calling it a rule. I don't know how flexible it actually is, but the word on the streets was that there were some Reiki masters that required $10,000 had to be paid up front in one lump sum, and she had that. So I don't know that it was up front in one lump sum, but she said, I've got two rules if I'm going to train you and certify you as a Reiki master. The first is $10,000. And I asked her about this, and I said, okay, I'm broke. I made the $500 happen so I could take this class. I know that at some point I can come up with 10 grand so that I can get the Reiki mastership through you. And I really wanted that. So that turned out to be something that was a very inspirational motivation for the next 15, 20 years of my life. And then she said her other rule, which just crushed me. And it was, my other rule, my other requirement is that you have to channel Reiki to someone while they pass away, while they die. You have to do a hands-on treatment to another person providing Reiki while they die. Actually, in her vocabulary, she did not use the term providing Reiki. In her vocabulary, she used the term channeling Reiki, because that was what you did back then. It's in a lot of these circles now, it's very different. People give Reiki, they send Reiki, but when I learned Reiki, that wasn't the process. The process was the person on the table just used you like the television antenna, and you were just a vessel. You were just a channel of the energy. You didn't get your personality involved, and you didn't tell them, or you didn't do anything with their energy that you thought needed to fix them. You sat back, you tried to move your personality out of the way as much as possible, and let them fix themselves, using you as a stepping stone to higher energies. And I don't believe that it's done that way anymore in the greater Reiki population, at least with those that I'm aware of. But having that requirement just crushed me, because it's like, oh my God, I'm certainly not going to go kill someone just so I can give them Reiki. But I said, well, it's like, well, how am I supposed to do that? And she says, well, you volunteer. You do hospice work. And you be patient. So I started to do just that. Now, Denise returned to Australia, and I never heard from her again, and I never knew what they were doing, what she and John, her husband John, were doing. But I stuck with those values. It felt right to me at the time that if this is one of her requirements, okay, if she could do it, she's done it, she's established that value because she's done it, she's gone through it, she's doing it, she's got that rule for a reason. So I said to myself, well, I'll go with it, and I'll just see if I can do this. And I did start doing volunteer hospice work for many, many years. And it was only about 5 years ago that I stopped. I decided to move on to other volunteer venues. And it changed me. Within a year and a half, I had channeled to a hospice patient. And I was at the side of their bed, and they passed away, and the energy flowed through, and it was undescribable. I just can't tell you how transformative, how spiritually transformative that experience was. And then my life got worse after that point. So where can we go? You can ask the next question.
Well, like, what do you mean by that? I'm totally intrigued with your story now. You got me on the edge of a cliff here.
There was really a profound spiritual awakening that I went through during that process.
I can totally imagine it. It's an interesting requirement. It's not one that I've ever heard before, but I do know what it's like, and it is very transformative, that's for sure.
Well, I wasn't ready for the experience. My personality was not ready for the experience.
Uh-huh.
And a while after, say 1996 eventually came around, and the internet came around, and as I mentioned, I was really messed up in the head. The friend who wanted me to go into Reiki really had much greater insight than I gave him credit for, other than just wanting, you know, a good friend to go through this class with him.
Uh-huh.
So he realized that I had a lot of mental problems. I've been blessed with a very healthy physical body. I just haven't had the normal health problems normal or average health problems that a person has by the time they're my age, but I had some severe mental problems.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of different reasons for this. And, I take responsibility for all of them. Ultimately, it's my life and they were my decisions. But I chose to do things in certain ways. And at that time, by the time the internet became available in 1996, I was very, very, very angry at a lot of different things, including members of the Reiki Alliance. And I started to do a lot of my own research, and because I had lived in Japan and could read an encyclopedia, not a Japanese encyclopedia, but I could do some basic research in the Britannica and what have you, I started to write little essays and things about the way I thought things were, and one of these essays was called The Reiki Wars, and I published this. I wanted to actually publish it on that news group, alt.healing.reiki, but at the time, people were still accessing the internet through regular phone lines. Bandwidth was a concern. If it's a long message, it would take a long time to download onto the computer. So I published it on a website. I secured a domain called The Reiki Wars, and it was a very short-lived domain. I did not renew it, and it only hosted the one essay that I talked about. But in this essay, what I did is I talked about what I discovered in my research about Japan, and I talked about the claims made by individuals who claimed to be a part of the alliance. So I want to emphasize that these are individuals who claimed to be a part of the alliance, or at least were associated with the alliance, because they came across as if they had the ineffable, undeniable truth. And I was very angry. And I presented a lot of information. I tried to do it in a logical way that said, look, this is the way Japan was back then. It's highly unlikely. Or actually, I wasn't that polite. I'm being very polite about what I said. I said it was just Usui could not have been a Christian. He could not have been a dean. In the essay, I said that it was still too close of a time to the Tokugawa shogunate, and Christians would have gotten their heads cut off if they said, you know, we're Christian. So there was a time in Japanese history when sword-carrying individuals, the samurai class, were authorized and encouraged to do that by the Japanese state. And I said that, and in my anger, I called your grandmother a charlatan. So I said, you know what Takata did is just totally out of greed, and she's just putting down all these edicts, and she's doing this bad thing, and she's doing that bad thing, and she can't really be teaching Reiki because she's doing this wrong, and she's doing that wrong. And what I was doing was basically, I was saying basically the same things to my students that Takata was saying, except I wasn't charging for it at the time. And eventually, I got called on that. And the argument was, well, how can you call her a charlatan when you're telling people, you're telling your students the exact same thing? And it left me dumbfounded. It's like, oh, I got slapped in the face with a brick. And it was very deserved, very deserved. So I kind of stopped, you know, calling names or pointing fingers there for a while, but the anger was still there for other reasons as well. And then around 2000, some Japanese teachers, Japanese national Reiki teachers emerged onto the public scene, and then I started to quiet down quite a bit. And I just decided to watch and see what happens with this, because of a lot of the criticisms that were gained against me for the way I was behaving at the time. I rather than continue to act that way, I did reach a point in my life where I said, I've got to change. So I'm digging myself into a hole here. There's just a lot of people are really, really, really angry with me about the things that I've said. You know, I've really insulted far too many people than I should have, and without saying I'm sorry. But in the same respect, I didn't know what it was that I was doing or see how what I was doing was incorrect, how it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I kicked back and just decided to watch things for a while. So my life also continued to self-destruct. By the time 2000 came around, actually 2001, I had started up an old relationship that never should have gone on as long as it did. The relationship was, a good 17 years long, but it was on again, off again. It was a love-hate relationship. The love usually only lasted about, 20 minutes at the most, and then it was hate for the rest of the time that we were together. But in that relationship, what I would do is we would get together, we would have a good time for about 20 minutes, and then everything would go horribly wrong. But the problem was we felt compelled to have a relationship. And when that would happen, I would let go of all my assets, and move in with the person and then try to start over without a solid footing. And then, well, the hate aspect would come in, and then I'd have to move out and then completely start over again. So by the time 2001 came around, that started the last phase of that learning cycle for me. And it got so bad that I really didn't have any place else to go. And I got to the point where I said that I'm going to do one of two things. And I said this to myself. I was either going to go homeless by the end of the year or commit suicide. And that was a commitment that I had made to myself. And by the end of the year, I had not made any progress finding a job. I could not financially reestablish myself. And because I do like to read, I had spent quite a bit of time at the library checking out books on how to commit suicide or how people have committed suicide. And I learned that statistically, most people who try to commit suicide fail. So there was the left brain approach, the logical approach running through my head that said, you know what? Your life has been a total failure up to this point. So if you try to commit suicide now, you know what's going to happen? You're not going to die. You're going to live. So with that reasoning, what I did is I packed up my car with what clothing I could. I also had a massage table. I drove to San Francisco. I lived out of my car, filled with clothing in the back and the massage table. I lived out of the car for a month. I slept under the bridges inside the car. I showered. I was able to shower because I had a membership at a gym, so I could go exercise and shower and at least be clean. But after a month, I completely ran out of money, and there was about a quarter tank of gas in the gas tank, and I just realized, you know what, this just ain't working. I've got to ask for help. So I went to the city. I got set up on welfare. They put me into a homeless shelter that same day. A week later, I had to let go of the car. I returned the car to the finance company. And I ended up living in a homeless shelter for 4 months. And the first week was really a culture shock. I guess I was in denial. And after the first week, though, once I started to realize that I was actually in a homeless shelter, and this was a group shelter, so it was a large open bay where there were 100 beds. It was only men that were allowed in, just so they don't have any problems with people doing stuff at night. And it was just this huge open bay, and by the end of that first week, once I realized that this is where I was, I just gave up. I at night I pulled the covers over my head, and I thought of higher spiritual energies called a Reiki, and I started to feel the same energies that I felt when Denise was doing the attunement, and I saw this bright light above me, and then the next thing I know, I mean, my eyes were closed and covers were over my head, but I saw this bright light above me, and then The next thing I know, it enveloped me, and I was waking up the next morning. So, and everything that next morning felt and looked completely different. And I don't know what it was, but just everything was different. And other homeless individuals, after that point, looked at me and said, "You don't belong here." And some of them said, in their exact words, "You're not one of us. I don't know why you're here, but it is not right for you to be here." And I just kind of shook my head at the time, saying, "Okay, well, I don't know what to do. This is where I am. You know, I've made bad decisions. You know, no, I don't drink. I don't do drugs. And here I am in a homeless shelter." So things turned out. Go ahead.
I just wanted to break in because I just want you to know it's a beautiful story, and I really appreciate your sharing it because it's just such a powerful story of healing and amazing. So thank you for being willing to share it with us. Please do go on.
Oh, thank you.
So well, you're in a homeless shelter, and, you know, I just think about whether you feel like it's accurate or not. I just feel like that we've all been to the depths of our soul. I think that Reiki takes us there sometimes because that's kind of how the healing starts.
We have to confront our own inner demons.
Yeah.
In professional writers' communities, of which I'm involved in, it's commonly called the dark night of the soul.
Uh-huh.
And that comes from Joseph Campbell. There was a very popular screenwriter who made it even more popular called Blake Snyder. Unfortunately, he died of a heart attack at a very young age, I think in his 30s. But it's the time when the hero of the story has to confront themselves. They reach this point of no return. It is the worst time in their life, and they do one of two things. They either change and become someone different, or they continue along their path of destruction and destruct. They self-destruct.
Right.
So things worked out. I when this light approached me, I just said, "I give up." My words to it were, "You lead the way." And I admitted to myself that all of the decisions I had been making in my life were wrong. Otherwise, you know, I'm not an entire idiot, and I'm not always going to go into denial, but if the decisions I did make in my life were so right, I wouldn't be living in a homeless shelter, for crying out loud.
Right.
So I was honest, and that's another key factor about my entire approach to all of this spiritual work is honesty, because it helps the process of change. And well, as things turned out, because I had, when I got the Reiki certifications, and in that same year that I did the Reiki level 1 and 2 and, 1 and 2 with Denise, I had gone on to someone else and done the Reiki master with someone else. But, I had also, gone through the massage training process and become a certified massage therapist. And interestingly enough, one of my motivations for doing that was if I could never get a job in corporate America, well, then I could do massage for a living. And that became true in 2002. While I was homeless, actually, because I didn't drink or do drugs, I saved my welfare check from the city. And I was eventually able to save up enough money so that I could actually rent a massage studio out of a business. And it started in a yoga studio, and business started to grow really fast. And then what happened is I invested some money into my training, and I went through some additional deep tissue therapy. And then after that deep tissue therapy training that I had, all of a sudden, I started to get individuals who were coming to me with broken bones and broken hips. Some individuals had just been released from a hospital after having been in a car accident where they broke their arms and their legs and even their back. And some of the clients came into the treatment studio in walkers. I mean, they were young guys, too, in their 40s. and 50s, and they had to use a walker because of these automobile accidents. And what happened was my practice, my massage practice, which started out as just the stereotypical relaxation process, grew into a medical massage practice. And I started to get so many clients that it was disrupting the yoga students' practice. So then I had to look for another place to do the practice. And I was no longer living in, after 4 months, I was able to get out of the homeless shelter, and I lived in what San Francisco calls or classifies a residential hotel, meaning you pay rent there on a weekly basis, and there's no lease, there's no commitment other than that week that you're there. So I had to find another place of business to run the practice. And I was very fortunate. I was able to find a chiropractic clinic that rented me a treatment space. And there it was just a perfect fit because the chiropractic clinic was a medical facility that perfectly complemented the way I was doing business. And business grew. And it just grew to the point where it started to degrade the cartilage in my knuckles. So my hands started to hurt. Now, part of that reason is because I did not learn proper techniques early enough. So if I had learned the techniques that I had, say, in 2003 or so, back in 1993, well, then it would have been a lot different. But my hands would have lasted much longer, but I learned the right techniques too late. And unfortunately, the damage was done. So by 2005, I decided that I have to close practice and do something else. And I was saving all of my money. I mean, I worked sometimes 18-hour days. It was just terrible. I had absolutely no life outside of that massage room for a few years. But with all the money that I made, I saved and I invested, and I eventually, I did try to get work as a web developer there for a little while, and I did for 1 year, but I decided, well, this just isn't a good environment for me as far as my personality is concerned, and I focused on teaching Reiki for the next few years. So from about 2006 to 2009, I taught Reiki full-time here in San Francisco. And it started as a group of a few people meeting in my apartment. And then that grew to renting a space at the local YMCA twice a month. And we would spend about 3 hours twice a month at the YMCA at the commercial space that I rented. And the group was paying for this. So it turned out to be, well, a very interesting learning experience as well. Because we had an open door policy, so anyone could come in. And everyone was encouraged, if they were going to attend more than two or three times, they were encouraged to pay a monthly participation fee, just as if you were actually joining a gym. But we started to get too many interesting individuals who needed more healing than I was qualified to provide. And I'm trying to put that in the best possible way.
That was very tactful.
You laughed, yes. So I think you know what I'm talking about. And I've actually heard some of your other shows. So but I decided because of those experiences that I did need another break, and I tried to take a break from Reiki, and it didn't work. So I guess, you know, it's gone really well for me, but I don't know how to describe this, because it's kind of like I've been trying to find my fit with Reiki as well. And part of that fit involved writing a book about Reiki. And the thing is, when I first started to write a book about Reiki, I was saying what every other author on the market is currently saying. And it's really interesting. I lost seven computers, or not seven, but six computers in that process. Literally, every time I started to really go forward and write a Reiki book the way everyone else was writing it, my computer would melt. The CPU would melt, the motherboard would melt, something would go wrong, I would get delayed for 3 or 4 weeks, waiting for the new parts to come in, waiting for replacement parts before I could continue writing. And in that time, though, every time that happened, I eventually got a new idea, and I made a change to the book. And then it started to go back to saying what everyone else was saying, then the computer would melt again. Well, I'm on my seventh computer now since that process. And when I got this thing, I said, all right, that's just it. I'm going to stop writing this book. I'm letting someone else write this book, just like I did when I was laying in bed in the homeless shelter. So I said, all right, what do you want me to say? I let go and from my control of what I thought needed to be said. And I said, all right, what do you want me to say? So I can't really say that what's in the current book is channeled because, well, technically it is, but in a lot of ways, it's not, because what it does is it addresses a lot of the deficiencies that are present in a greater mainstream Reiki community. And that involves deficiencies of communication. Because of my time in hospice and even doing massage, I learned how to communicate with patients. And I find that a lot of Reiki practitioners whom I have met who want to go into the hospitals and be recognized don't have those communication skills. And the book, as a result of this, the book addresses that. And it's a book of a lot of things, but it's mostly a book about client therapist communication, I suppose. And once I had let go of the idea of just retelling the same story that everyone else is telling and write something a little bit different, then the computer stopped melting. So, in fact, it's still working. So I'm pretty happy with that decision to go forward like that. But I'm just talking and talking and talking. So if you could give me some lead on where you want me to go from here. Give me a question or something, because I won't stop.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I'm following your train of thought. It's very good. And I guess we're now up to the present, right?
We are at the present,
We
yes.
are at the present. So that's really great, because, you know, Buck, I just love your story. I think it's an amazing story of oral tradition, of, you know, resistance to hearing a call, and yet following through, and reaping the benefits of something that really was like this light on your path. You know, when my grandmother had died, and at that time she was more my grandmother than my master, of course. Mm-hmm. I went to a memorial service that was given by a Buddhist priest and who knew her, and he said, "Well, she was like, her Reiki was like a light in a forest, and it led her to deeper and deeper into the forest, and she allowed other people to have the same light." And I really liked that image, and that's what I was thinking of when I was hearing your story.
That causes me to reflect back onto the character arc of the reversal that I've gone through, because, as I said, you know, say 20 years ago, I was calling your grandmother a charlatan, but now I've gone through such a transformation. It's like, oh my God, what an incredible person, and just how blessed you are to have had her, to have her as your grandmother and as a guiding light. It's just amazing, and I so wish that I could have met her. And I've listened to her speak through your podcast and through other tapes, and she just had such a transformative presence. I one of the regrets that I have in my life is that I did not know her, that I did not have the opportunity to meet her. But I can't, you know, cry over spilled milk. I don't know what the right cliche is, but I was too young at the time. It never would have happened, and I was in the Midwest. So, you know, what can I do? It's just fate. But
one of my regrets, which I am really sad about, is that in our technology now, and in what I know about technology, period, because I was very non-techo when I was 30 and 40, when I was with her, just when I turned 30, it was like, just imagine a little video camera of her and just taking a video and being able to see her in action. I mean, it's not the same as in person, but you're right. She did carry a certain energetic field that there is no way that I can communicate that to other people. Because, you know, number one, it always comes off as kind of bragging, and I don't want to do that. Because it pushes people away into a place that doesn't feel like that's the direction, obviously, that I want them to go. And at the same time, for myself, I just have to speak for myself that, as I said, you know, when I started out, when I was in 1980, when she died, she was much more my grandmother than my master. And now she's much more my master than my grandmother, although she's obviously both. But I have gained an incredible appreciation for what she did. And obviously it's been working, because I'm still practicing Reiki and I'm not bored. I find my life very rich and beautiful and not easy. I mean, it's not an easy life, because as you begin the story, it's really about becoming authentic and being able to come to your own truth. And that's not easy. That's not an easy path.
I can only agree with you, and I'm reflecting back on an analogy that you gave just a moment ago, was that your grandmother was this bright light in the forest, and for years, I've used the saying, and this is as far back as the 1996 days of alt.healing.reiki, but I was saying that bright lights in the forest attract a lot of bugs. And the thing is, the bugs aren't really these nasty little critters. They, as a metaphor, they are people in need of healing. And the light that's coming through you is just amazingly brilliant. And I'm not saying that only to flatter you, but I'm saying it because I'm always brutally honest with people. And I really wish, I mean, because... I mean, here I was calling your grandmother a charlatan 20 years ago, saying that everything that she was doing was wrong. Now, not only do I wish that I could have been one of her students, but now, because I see so many problems in the greater Reiki community, I really wish that more people were doing what you're doing, because what you're doing, it goes beyond the oral tradition. See, where you're different than everyone else right now that I've come across in the Reiki community is that you are actually teaching everyone else, and I may be included in this other category that I'm going to give, is preaching. Because the preachers are just repeating information of others. But by teaching, what you're doing is you're always working with new information, and the medium may be have a lot of similar. There may be a lot of similarities with what you do from session to session to session, but you're teaching, and by teaching in the way you are, you're always allowing for something different to happen, and for some new change within the person to occur. And yeah. I don't see others doing that in the Reiki community, and I really wish that I did, to be honest. And you've got a gift with this type of interviewing ability, because I don't have that. So I envy you because of that.
Well, thank you very much, and it's really good to hear because it's my intent. And one of the things that I would like to ask you about, sort of like, not just you and I, when I say we, but the Reiki community, it's like, for me, what I always have to remember about everyone and every story that I hear is that Reiki is about healing. And healing is not always pretty, and it's certainly not always comfortable. And it's not always what I want and what other people want. So, you know, I have no idea what the big umbrella looks like. But sometimes when I can be very when I'm in my most compassionate space, which is, you know, not always, and also in my great hope for humanity, that I feel that, you know, whatever is happening in Reiki and with Reiki students, whoever they are, whatever they're writing, whatever process they're going through, they're doing it because it is their healing process. And it's not about, you know, I don't feel that my goal for the Reiki world is to become all of a sudden peaceful or all of a sudden in agreement, because that just wouldn't be human. But I do really want a kind of authenticity to arise, and this is not about being factually correct, but a kind of authenticity from people, meeting people, so that we can meet in the place, perhaps, I would like to think, where you and I are meeting today, which is this place of being passionate about Reiki, about being in awe of the space that Reiki gives us inside of ourselves, and having lived a life that we've actually come through where we know that we are a better person and more authentic than we were before. And all those places that you described in your story, I can totally relate to in my own life.
Mm. I'll sign up for that.
Well, you know, it. The outside was a bit different, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, the human factor that's involved is so much the same.
It is.
It's really difficult to be righteous.
Well, I think it's difficult to be righteous and right. I meet quite a few people who make it look like it's easy, but the truth is a different matter altogether.
Right. So thank you very much for everything, for being willing to be here with me today. It's great.
Well, you're welcome. Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. It was really a pleasure, and I absolutely love speaking with you.
Oh, great. So I have one last question.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know what your dream is for the Reiki world.
My dream for the Reiki world. I'm going to go with baby steps. Because when we go back to that analogy of being a bright light in the forest attracting
right.
a lot of bugs, the bugs don't just evaporate and die and go away.
Right.
Because they're people, what happens is they change. So there may be some darkness that may be shed, but other parts of that darkness are transformed. It's not banished. It's not buried away in the dirt for something else, some more powerful thing to recycle or heal, but it's changed through a process of ourselves, a process of personal volition, of admittance that, okay, it's time for me to change. It's time
right.
for me to heal into something new. I with that in mind, I would like the community to start being, and this is the global Reiki community.
Right, exactly.
More honest with itself about where it is. I've encountered an awful lot of people who speak behind Reiki practitioners' backs. I've been involved in social circles where once the Reiki practitioner leaves, they don't know that I'm involved in Reiki. Once the known Reiki person leaves, they start to say all these terrible things about them. And it's building up. So there is more professional disrespect out there than Reiki practitioners may care to admit to themselves. And I think that the way that the Reiki community can begin changing that is by being honest with itself and taking responsibility for the things around it, taking on some social responsibilities, like communicating properly to other people, being nice to people, in a way that people deserve to be nice rather than the way that the Reiki practitioner says, well, they need to be treated nice this way. So it's a big question, though. I haven't really thought of a global or an overall goal, but the first one would be, if I simplify it, I'm sorry I'm rambling, but it would just be honesty. We've got to start being honest with ourselves, because if we're not honest with ourselves, then we just lie to ourselves even more. And the less lies we have to ourselves, or about ourselves, to ourselves, the more doorways open to change.
I totally agree. Great. Thank you. It's not an easy road, but I feel like it's a road that Reiki really calls us to be on. And I'd like to take my next steps in doing this, and so.
What are those next steps?
What are the next steps? Well, I think that my next steps are to just be thoughtful about what I'm doing, and also to see the places where I'm not being honest, I'm being protective. And I think that is such an interesting knife edge to walk. And I can't think of anything right now, but I know the feeling, right? So it'll be interesting to see. Thank you very much for drawing that to my attention. I appreciate it.
I'm just trying to make conversation. I'm not trying to.
Right. Well, you know. let's not do the disclaimer part, okay?
Since we're speaking honestly, you're an icon, you're an avatar in the Reiki community. And, you know, it's created a lot of conflict. And it's that conflict which has caused me to initially start contacting you a few weeks ago, because I'm tired of the discrepancy between what I feel from you, the spiritual energies I get coming out of you and through your talk shows and through your websites and the rumors that other people spread.
Uh-huh.
And I hope that at some point with the works that I produce, I can help heal that rift. Because, again, it comes down to not being honest with oneself about who a person is or how they perceive other people. So you're in a difficult situation. And it's in some ways it's a no-win situation, but in other ways it's a very important situation because of the future.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. I'm rambling. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm overstepping my bounds here. So, sorry.
Well, we haven't cut it off yet.
Oh, okay. But, well, you know, people project their own problems onto people like you.
Yeah.
And they project their own shortcomings onto people like you. And I did. You know, I did that first with your grandmother, and with you, I never really knew what was going on, because with you, honestly, I was always confused. Because, really, because there's what people were saying, there was the promotional literature coming out that was, I'm sorry for saying this, but coming out against you, and what I sensed about you. I mean, several years ago, there was one of the incarnations of your website. You had a very large banner, and you were standing on an open meadow in an open field. And I that's the website that it was. But what had happened was I'd been reading all this negative stuff about you again, and I'm like, oh, my God, what a monster. I've got to go check this monster out for myself. You know, I've got an active third eye, so I can take a look at this, and I want the pants. I just want to have the pants scared off of me. So I went to your website to take a look and get a good scare, see the monster show, and I get there, and there you are on this open field in the afternoon. You're on top of these rolling hills, at least that's the way I remember it, with trees in the background, and you're facing the camera, and you're smiling, and I'm like, monster, monster, monster. And I meditate, I start to relax, and I want to tune into this monstrous energy, and I was just blown away at the beauty of the radiant light. And I'm like, well, why are people saying all these things? It's just, I don't get it. And I just held that confusion until a few weeks ago when I contacted you, because it's like, enough of this. You know, it's just, I've got to be honest about all this stuff, and we've got to put an end to these rumors that are coming out. Right. And, you know, Pamela Miles in one of these forums said that she called it recycled internet information, and I'm tired of that. I'm tired of the recycled internet information. So,
right. Well, you know, it's very interesting to be to hold a position that I do that is what I would call a recognized position. So it doesn't come because I declared it. It comes because people recognize something in me. And, you know, this happens to every human being. I mean, we recognize our mother, and so our mother becomes a mother because we recognize this woman as a child, as our mother. And it's the same for every teacher that we've ever had, whether we like them or not. And it's also the same for spiritual practices. So that's one thing that's really interesting and you don't get much training for in the real world, so to speak. And then there's me as a human being. So, of course, it's very confusing. And it was really confusing for me in the first 10 years because, you know, I had a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, I said a lot of things because I was very reactive in those days. I mean, I think maybe you might hear something of yourself in this story. So, you know, the more that Reiki has taken a hold of my life and the more that I've really allowed myself to change and to shift into more of my authentic self, then these two parts of me start coming together because, in truth, each one of us human beings has this part of ourselves that's our personality and that functions in a way that sometimes can be very reactive and so on. And it makes life really interesting. But then there's this other part of ourselves that really knows the oneness and the truth of spirit. And that's what Reiki does, as far as I'm concerned, is to bring out both of those parts of who we are so that we can be balanced, but also they can be integrated. And integration is where it's at. And, you know, it's totally understandable for me that people are confused. And, there's nothing I can do about my humanness, and there's, in some way, nothing I can do about this other part of me that people see and feel as a spiritual being. But it's... Mm-hmm. You know, it's just all of us. So I just get to be out there in the spotlight and, you know, it's my life. You know, I've really owned it as my, you know, what I need to heal myself. This is what I was given in my life. I was given it not because, you know, I'm a better person, but because this is what I needed to promote my own wholeness. And mm-hmm. it has certainly done that.
Well, I think you're doing it in the right way, especially with this talk show.
Yeah,
so, I mean, this, I can reach out, I can listen to your talk show all the time, so I'm very grateful that you do it, too. So it's making a difference in my life.
Well, thank you. I appreciate hearing that. Appreciate it. Well, our time is up, and I guess on that note, we will say goodbye. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.